You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
We have the distinct honor and great pleasure of welcoming Benjamin Ferenz to be with us today. As you know, Ben is a hero in his own time. He is someone who studied quite some time ago at Harvard Law School under Roscoe Pound, one of the great legal scholars of the age, and then went off with the U.S. Army and ended up as a prosecutor at Nuremberg, and is the last surviving prosecutor from those extraordinary times. And he's going to tell us a bit about those times. And then he went on and became a visionary, believing that what had happened at Nuremberg could in fact give life to a permanent institution. And long before states came around to that point of view, Ben Ferenz was advocating for the idea of a permanent international criminal court. And lo and behold, he had success. And of course, in 1998, states finally signed the Rome Statute. And here we are, we have the court that's come into being, and we'll talk a little bit about how that court is fulfilling its aspirations or Ben's aspirations. So Ben, if I could ask you to begin just to tell folks a little bit about your extraordinary history. I had the great pleasure of hearing it from you one-on-one some time ago, and I found myself just so taken with the incredible life you've led. But could you tell us a bit how you got to Nuremberg and what that was like?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
What's the statute of limitations for crime is what I want to know. And the reason I ask that is that my earliest memories begin around the corner on West 56th Street, Hell's Kitchen, right around your corner. I was then rather young. It was 94 years ago. And I had early made up my mind that I wasn't going to go with the gangs, and I was going to try to stop crime. I thought it was terrible, and it was at that time. It was really a high-density crime area, as I found out later when I became a criminologist and had charts. So that if you want to know how to get this job, all you have to do is have an ideal and work at it for about 90 years. And you'll be invited and given a half a sandwich.
And not any time to eat it, right?
Eat it. However, he did offer to carry down my tea, but I was going to spill it all over myself. However, so that gives you a little bit of the beginning. Now,
do you have to be so brutally honest?
I'm always brutally honest. Okay. When I went to City College in New York, Townsend Harris High School, which then was a school for gifted boys. I had never gotten any gifts. I didn't know.
Am I right that you spent some time growing up in Hell's Kitchen?
Yes, absolutely. That's my earliest memories. It's right here around the corner. They built a police station there in my honor sometime later. So that would see the connection. You know, it's called Home Week, coming back here. And to give you some idea, I remember on 9th Avenue when the streetcars were being pulled by horses.
Wow.
And the tracks are still under the car there. So it takes a while to get things done. However, I did. How much time? When do I have to finish here?
You're doing great.
So far, I'm doing great. He wants to stop me after 1 minute. I wanted to know how long I've got. How much detail should I tell you? I don't want to describe the horses. Anyway, I applied for a scholarship. I applied to Harvard Law School, and they accepted me. I won a scholarship for my exam on criminal law because I knew all about criminals. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know a lawyer. And, well, the war came along, and everybody I knew tried to enlist, including me. I thought I would be an airline pilot, learn the trade. I might use it in later life, but they said my feet wouldn't reach the pedal, so I was not qualified for that. and a navigator. My eyes weren't good enough. And I also wrote first to the CIA, and was not the CIA, it was the FBI at the time, to get me a job. I spoke French, learned it in school pretty well, and I thought they dropped me behind the German lines in France, occupied France. I would raise hell with the Germans. And they refused because I was a security risk. How do you get a security risk? Well, they required that you be a citizen for at least 15 years. My parents were poor immigrants coming from Transylvania, the home of Dracula, you all know about him. My uncle on my mother's side. And, and they said I hadn't been a citizen long enough, so I was a security risk. I did get in, and the Army, since I had no money, I had to work for a living. I worked at the Divinity School as a busboy, where they allowed me to eat what was left over, and I could eat in one afternoon enough to keep me alive for a week. And I got a job as a research assistant to Professor Sheldon Gluck, who was doing a book on war crimes. So I read everything in the Harvard Law Library there was on war crimes. I made a summary of every single one, and I became quite knowledgeable of the whole subject of war crimes. So when the Army finally called me, they recognized this great talent on my part, Harvard Law School, expert on war crimes, so they made me a private in the artillery. I was a typist in the supply room, and I couldn't type either. So the Army and I didn't get along well. If I wrote a book, Mein Kampf, it would be against the U.S. Army. However, I was mentioning to Jim that yesterday I got a letter from West Point. I did a lecture there about a week ago to the cadets. I'd been there before. Glowing praise. You're an inspiration. They were only angry, but we didn't film the whole thing. He said, of course, there are some people who have some doubts, but overwhelmingly, he said, you know, you won the day completely. That was yesterday. I'm busy all the time, working all the time. You won't believe my calendar. I'm going to Madrid in a few days' time to have there's a big conference there on universal jurisdiction problems. Anyway, to get back to the story here. So I don't want to tell you the horrors of war, because some of you are still eating lunch. But you'll know about them. But I landed on the beaches of Normandy. I went through the Maginot Line, Siegfried Line, crossed the Rhine on a pontoon boat. And by that time, the Army had been ordered to set up war crimes trials, and a colonel was appointed, and they transferred me from the artillery to General Patton's headquarters. And the colonel said, I've been directed to set up a war crimes program. Your name has been forwarded from Washington. I was then a corporal. What's a war crime? I believe I was the first person in the United States Army to deal with war crimes in World War II. I was the war crimes branch, 3rd U.S. Army. Pretty soon we got some reinforcements. The second man was Robert Nowitz, Buck Private, in the engineers, who spoke Hebrew, who spoke French, and he and I were a team after that, but I was the first guy on the scene. Anyway, one of the jobs I had, besides digging up bodies of American flyers who'd been shot down and try to find the people who had murdered them on the ground when they landed, was to go into the concentration camps and get the evidence of the crimes. And I did. And I don't want to go into too much detail because I can't. You'll find all of these materials are in the Holocaust Museum in Washington. Some of those, including the letters I wrote home to my girlfriend. We didn't have partners in those days. We've been married now, I think, happily for about 68 years, describing what I saw and my reaction to it. And my reaction, in brief, was it was quite horrible. It was all quite horrible. People do not, in my presence, say it didn't happen. That no one has dared say anything like that in my presence. It happened. And it happened in ways which are unimaginable to a rational human mind. And of course, that had a tremendous impact on me. The war was over, and The Nuremberg trials had started. I had been already working on war crimes in the U.S. Army military commissions, which have been forgotten. There is a photograph in the Holocaust Museum of my hammering up a big sign, U.S. Third Army War Crimes Trials, War Crimes Commission. And there's where we tried, the guards who we captured in the camps, including the commanders, and the people who had murdered the American flyers and British flyers when they came to the ground, and some of whom I had dug up with my hands. Sorry. Anyway, the war was over, and I went home with 10 million other guys looking for a job, and I was graduated from the Harvard Law School. I met a classmate of mine.
Didn't you first go into private practice then?
No, I came right out of Harvard into the Army. I came back when the war was over.
Right.
Yes. But I hadn't had time to get into private practice. I was looking for a job.
Right.
I met a classmate of mine who was the law clerk for Justice Jackson. And we met on the corner of Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street, in front of the public library.
Justice Robert Jackson of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Robert Jackson, U.S. Supreme Court judge, on leave to become the chief prosecutor for the United States in the International Military Tribunal, IMT, trial, which took place, and that's the famous trial against Goering and company. That had already started. I had no part of that. And I met this friend of mine, Murray Gartner, his name, if there are any people, old people here. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm the clerk to Justice Jackson, but he's never here. He's up over there in Nuremberg. And I said, well, I've been doing the same sort of stuff for the Army of War Crimes trials, which I haven't gone into details, but the War Crimes trials, to take a minute on that so you get your bearings, would be a room a little bigger than this, not much necessarily, and the defendants would be sitting like this way, just about the number in this room, a little bit elevated, like in a basketball court, and each one had a big sign on them, you know, with his number 27 and the other one 29, and there was a lieutenant here who was the prosecutor, and there was another lieutenant there who was the defense counsel, and there was a judge, or maybe even three judges in the middle, who were the judges. Usually it was one, and that was a higher rank. It was either a captain or maybe a major, and as far as I could make out, none of them had any legal experience, and the trials went like this. I'm looking for a victim. Herr Schmidt, stand up. Stand up, Herr Schmidt. You are accused of being a god in the Munchausen concentration camp where terrible crimes against humanity were being committed against innocent victims, and they were tortured and brutalized, and you were an accomplice and assistant. What have you got to say for yourself, guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Sit down. Next. Come to the next one. Not guilty, I was only a cook. This Herr Schmidt, he was short of breath, he was just ran out of good alibis. I was a cook, I was carrying out orders and so on. Then the captain or the major would go to the next room, come back 15 minutes later. All of the defendants are found guilty and sentenced to death. A few years, many years later, I guess, I went to the Landsberg prison where some of my acquaintances had been interred, and I asked one of the officers there, how many people were executed here at Landsberg? He said about 1,000. That was the trial, an average of about maybe 2 minutes a person per capita. So nobody knows about that. They don't talk about that. I met a lieutenant colonel who was in charge of war crimes for the U.S. Army. A few years later, we had lunch together somewhere. And I started telling her, I said, you know anything about the Dachau trials? They took place in the Dachau concentration camp because that we were stationed in Munich, Captain Army were there, and that was sort of symbolic, and it was a camp, and it was available. And she'd never heard of them. And I have searched for my reports. I wrote reports of what I saw in the camp, and I collected the evidence, including lampshades, including stroken heads, including testimony from witnesses, all kinds of fascinating stories, which incidentally, my name, www.benferez.org. They're all available to you on my website. Everything there is free. all of my books, all my articles, the DVDs, lectures, all of them.
So, Ben, tell us how you got, because you ended up trying the Eisenrotzen Rubin case, is that right?
Tell me. It's the Einsatzgruppen.
Okay, so what was that? What was that?
That was a special word to disguise what their action was. Nobody could translate it. Einsatz means action, Gruppen is groups, literally. Action groups. Nobody knew what they do. Their assignment was to follow behind the German lines, and they never said murder. Eliminate every single Jewish man, woman, and child that they could lay their hands on. The same for gypsies, and the same for any other presumed enemies of the Reich. And that's what they did. 3,000 men divided into four different companies, following behind the German lines, Einsatzgruppe A, Einsatzgruppe B, C, and D. And every day, they sent a Reichsmeldungen aus der UdSSR, try saying that one, reports from the Eastern Front. And in those reports, they said, Einsatzkommando 10 of Einsatzgruppe A, under the command of Major or Colonel so-and-so, succeeded in eliminating the statistics down the line. One of my researches, my first assignment when I went back, was to get evidence for the 12 subsequent trials which were being planned, because the International Military Tribunal trial had a big spotlight, but it didn't explain how a country like Germany, a civilized country, could let that happen. So we wanted to put on trial representatives of the industry, the medical profession, the lawyers who perverted the law, the SS that carried it out, the army who collaborated. So we set up a series of a dozen trials. Since I was the only one around who had any experience as an investigator, Telford Taylor, who hired me for the job, we were later law partners down here in the Pan Am building, he said, you go to Berlin, get all the evidence you can, all these trials. So with the staff, about 50 people, I put them all together, and I sent people to go through the Foreign Office files, the Gestapo files, the SS files, if they were still intact. Many of them were completely shattered, or where they had hidden the documents, and produce the evidence. Anything relating to any of these possible charges flow through, and one of my researchers came in with these reports from the Eastern Front. And I took a little hand adding machine, I began to add. When I added 1 million people killed, I said, that's enough. I got a sample, I flew down to Nuremberg. I said, by that time he was general. I said, General, we have to open another trial against these murders. He said, we can't. The Pentagon hasn't approved it. There's no funds. All the lawyers are assigned. We can't start now with a new trial. They're just beginning to roll with the others. I said, you cannot let these mass murderers go free. It's impossible. You can't do that. He said, can you do it in addition to your other work? And I said, sure. So he said, okay, you got it. So I became the chief prosecutor for the United States in what was certainly the biggest murder trial in human history. And what will interest you even more, I arrested the prosecution's case after 2 days. And I didn't call a single witness, because I had learned in law school the best evidence is contemporaneous documentary proof. And I had it top secret, and I had the distribution list as well, the 99 people who received it later said they didn't know anything about it. So I arrested my case in 2 days. Convicted all of them. 13 of them were sentenced to death.
Did they get fair trials?
The trial was absolutely fair. But, well, I would put it another way. The trial was absolutely unfair. And I'll tell you why. I was a young boy. I was 27 years old then. And I had three other assistant lawyers whom I scrounged from some of the other cases. Wanted to get rid of them. I had one who was pretty competent. The others, they should have dumped them long ago. And on the other side, I had 22 defendants, each one of whom was entitled to a defense counsel of his choice and an assistant defense counsel of his choice. So we had 22 defendants with two lawyers. That's 44 lawyers, the best, the cream of the crop in Germany. 44 lawyers against my first case, totally inexperienced prosecutor. Is that fair? Well, why I said yes, was because I had the evidence. I had the documents. And all of them, if I've had time, I'll tell you some more funny stories, but I want to come to, what time we have to finish here?
Well, we're gonna go on to, I want you to get you to the ICC in a couple of minutes.
Yes, as we want to get on to today, this is all past history. Anyway, they were all convicted. In fact, only four were executed. The rest of them were given clemency, not because the trials were unfair, but because they were comparing humanitarian considerations. Two guys got different crimes for different punishment for the same crime, or family conditions, or his health, or so on. So that was to be taken into consideration by a clemency board, which was appointed to examine it, making specifically sure that they are not to challenge the legality of any conclusion of law or fact by any of the subsequent trials. That's ignored. It was true.
Hello? Do we have somebody on the line that can mute?
That's Sandra. All right. Open the door.
So
now I'm going to greet Sandra Schulberg, the late Sandra Schulberg. She's still alive. She's a producer of a great film of the International Military Tribunal trial. And she's been pushing that all around the world very effectively. And she's an old friend, and she threatened to come down here and seize me after this. So you know what's going to happen. Anyway, so there we are.
Can I ask you a question? When you were doing this trial, the way you described how it happened,
yeah. It
seemed very, I mean, you found this evidence and yeah. Nobody had prepared for it, and you just said, well, I'll do it in addition to my
normal
work. Did it seem to you at that time that you were, was it clear to you that you were doing one of the most important things?
No. We thought that it would be over and we'd go home and live a normal life. Had no idea or no desire to be making history. Someone had said to me, when you're 95, you'll be telling a bunch of kids in New York to a multi-billionaire how to avoid killing all the people. He's out of his mind. And I've mentioned you meeting on 42nd Street and these purely chance encounters which determine your destiny. In fact. All right, let me go on now. So, we're finished with Nuremberg.
So then you went back to private practice, is that
well,
correct?
Well, then, no.
No, I never get it right.
No. You divide my life up into different sections. I'll come to private practice.
Okay.
The first segment was getting a good education, learning your stuff. There's no substitute for that. I'd read everything. The next thing is winning the war. You think Patton won the war without me? War was over. The next thing is getting a hold of the culprits who caused it so that the rest of the world should know not to try that again. They're not going to get away with it, not for me anyway. So the next thing was the deterrent effect of holding responsible criminals. Then comes the next step, which is often forgotten, was forgotten then too. What about the victims? What do you do for the victims? And I was approached, the initiative did not come from me, but I was approached by a representative of the major Jewish organizations in the world saying that they had managed to get a provision into the military government law that property that's been taken under duress, which meant Jewish property fundamentally, could be reclaimed by the owner and restored to him, and unclaimed and heirless property would go to a charitable organization to be used, the benefits would be used for the benefit of the survivors. Well, that sounded, you know, reasonable, very nice. And they said, we want you to do it. You know your way around the army. By that time, I had been promoted from to sergeant. When I got out of the army, it was an honorable discharge as a sergeant of infantry. And when I went back for the Nuremberg trials, they promoted me from sergeant to colonel. I wouldn't go into the army, so they gave me a simulated rank. And I had all the rights and privileges of a colonel. I said, you mean I can stick it to the lieutenant colonels who've been sticking it to me for 3 years? They said, yes. I said, I'll take it. Anyways, then I'm pretty sure I got to put it in general. But the person said, you know your way around the army. You've got a high rank. We want you to do the job. Can you do this? We don't have any money. We can't invest our money in, you know, this sort of goose chase, but we have enough to pay you a salary for about 6 months, then we'll do it. And I talked to my wife, who was also a refugee from Transylvania. We had been married in New York after the war, right after the war. I finished my education, and as soon as I got an offer of a job, we got married. It was 67, 68 years ago, and we have never had a quarrel. Anyway, they said, will you do it? I said, okay. I talked to my wife. I said, they've come with this thing, and she said, how long did they ask you to stay? I said, well, they asked me to promise 2 years. And I said, well, she said, well, I know you. If they say 2 years, 1 year you'll be finished, no, we'll postpone it. So we can't say no, okay? That, my friends, was the most difficult job of all, because what we had to do was try to compensate the victims of these terrible crimes against humanity as well. We began by restoring property. Mission impossible. Properties had been bombed, the currency had been devalued. They were supposed to give back whatever they received and in exchange for getting the property back. They received they received 10,000 Reichsmarks. 10,000 Reichsmarks were only worth 1,000 Deutsche Marks. And they said, what do you mean? I paid 10, I'm only getting one. Currency conversion, who bears the risk of the loss? Interesting philosophical problem. The net result, the present possessors of the property said Hitler should have killed you too. Because you come, the house was bombed, we repaired the furnace, we paid off the mortgage, and now you come and you claim the property, which has never been claimed by my friend, Herr Cohen, who fled with the money, and he went to Israel and he thanked me, or he went to Brooklyn and he thanked me. Impossible. And soon realized I was generating more anti-Semitism and trying to win the cases in the courts. We had the highest court was an Allied restitution court. And I don't want to go into it. We haven't got time to go into it. But to create a new legal system in which the victims would be compensated directly by the wrongdoing state that flowed after the restitution of real property, Adenauer, German Chancellor, said we have to, terrible crimes have been committed in the name of the German people, and we have an obligation to try to make amends. Mm-hmm. And so we worked and negotiated a complete Bundesentschädigungsgesetz, federal restitution law, providing compensation for the individual survivors. Big, fat thing has been modified several times since then. An army of bureaucrats to deal with claims, a million claims coming in to be adjudicated, how much were the injuries to the victims, and how do you measure that? How do you measure the value of a person, of a human life? Is grandma worth more than grandpa? All of these problems had to be dealt with by a small group who was part of a team. I was part of a team, but I was an important part of the team. I don't know if I had any real experience in the field. Well, that program is still going on today. And the German government has paid out, the West German government, when they were unified, the East Germans came along with the same, has paid out literally billions and billions of dollars to the individual victims, all of whom say they didn't get enough and they're right. But then the Germans say they paid too much, and that's a political question. All of that took place with a country which was not in existence, the New Germany, also paid $3 billion, I think we had dollars, to the State of Israel for having given refuge to the victims, a state which was not in existence when the crimes occurred, and on an individual basis directly from the government held responsible or agreeing to accept responsibility, all without precedent. And it was impossible to really carry that out. That's why it's still going 50 years later. We scratched the surface, and the best we could do was to write into the law, in Article 50, I think it is, or the Rome Statute, that the victims are entitled to restitution, compensation, and rehabilitation. Those three words, I said, leave it later for the philosophers to work out how you do that in a country which is destitute, bombed out, and they got nothing. And so that was another compliment. All right.
So let me just.
And now I'm going home.
Wait, we got a few minutes of time.
Home.
So you've just adverted to the ICC. So let's just jump forward if we can, Ben. I mean, extraordinary history you're telling us.
You from this experience and elsewhere, you had the dream of an international criminal court. You started writing about it. You wrote books about it.
Yes.
And eventually, in the 1990s, it became possible for this to actually come to fruition.
Yes.
Let
me put the paste in between. When this program was in full swing, I couldn't afford to feed my family. I had four kids born in Nuremberg. You say, how'd you do that? Well, the courts were sometimes in recess. Anyway, I went home and looked for a job, and I had the same experience Alfred Taylor had when he went home. It was not a long time. The big law firm wanted to know how many clients do you bring. I had no clients. I had handled hundreds of thousands of Nazi victim claims, but that was as an underpaid employee of a big organization. And so they were not interested. So eventually I went into partnership with Telford Taylor, who was doing the same. And he went off to teach at Columbia Law School, and then later at Cardozo. And I said, the hell with this. I'm going to go. My kids were grown. They weren't paying any attention to me anyway. I'm going to try to save the world. And I was about 50 years old, which was about 45 years ago. And I said, okay, how do you save the world? First, you study the facts. Where did it happen? I went to the United Nations. I got myself accredited somehow to some of the organizations. I went to the UN Library. I went to the libraries in Geneva. I read everything. And then I began to put them together in books. Two volumes on defining international aggression, two volumes on an international criminal court, two volumes on enforcing international law, and then I wrote other volumes to explain the six volumes. So, because my wife said, nobody's going to read all those volumes, write something simple. So I wrote all these books, all of which are available to you free of charge. Okay, now we come to the court. It was obvious to me from the beginning, when I was in law school, if you have international crimes, you've got to have an international court. They were interested in counterfeiting originally. The thing got hot when in Trinidad and Tobago, the man who had been in the government there, but who was out of a job, was voted out of office in 1972. We met in Wingspread, Wisconsin, for a conference on international criminal law. Professor Louis Sohn of Harvard was in the chair. And we began in 1972 to talk about creating an international criminal court. The first Assembly of the United Nations had voted for continuation of the Nuremberg Principles by creating an international court, preparing a code of crimes, a special committee to deal with aggression. All of that was a subterfuge, an excuse to do nothing, which they do and did very well. When they hadn't made any progress on that, so we began to draft statutes for a court. And when the man from Trinidad, A.N.R. Robinson, was prime minister, or president, I don't remember which, but he had the power, he moved it in the General Assembly of the United Nations to put it on the agenda, an international criminal court. Because he was a state representative, they had to accept it, and they began to talk about an international criminal court. I'm sorry to inform you, as I told them in Washington a few weeks ago, he died in Washington. He died in Trinidad a few weeks ago, and the president of Trinidad called me up in Washington to tell me, and I informed the American Society of International Law, to pause a moment in memory of a man from a small town, small country, whose initiative made it possible to have the International Criminal Court. People attribute me with the responsibility for that, but he was there and I was there, and he's the guy who put it on the agenda, not me. So I want to straighten that one out. Okay.
Can I jump ahead? The court exists. The court's now been going for more than 10 years.
Right.
And a lot of people are asking questions about how well it's doing. On the one hand, people say it's only got a few verdicts at all under its belt. It's not doing very well, including one acquittal. It's run into problems and criticism for the judges. Moreover, some people feel like it's actually not a court that's for everybody. It's only for weak states. Mm-hmm. The big states have stayed out, including the United States. So, how well are we approximating what you were hoping for in any event?
Well, I will answer your question briefly. But first, I have to mention briefly that when they finally reached the point of closing their first case against Mr. Lubango for stealing child soldiers and putting them in, the chief prosecutor, Marino Ocampo of Argentina, sent me a note saying, Ben, we want you to make the closing statement, which I did. So the closing remarks were made by me, and I was, that was the first case of the International Criminal Court. The first case, my first case as a lawyer in criminal law was in the Nuremberg trial against the Einsatzgruppen. My second case was the first case of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. In the first one, I was 27 years old. The second one, I was 92. So these are the two bookends of the effort to create international criminal law. How is the court doing? Depends how you look at it. I think they're doing terrible. And lest you misquote me, I think under the circumstances, it's fantastic, the progress that we have made. Because, let me deal with the court itself. This is a prototype court. It's the first time in history they've set out to offer the defendant in complete detail, overplayed detail, all of the rights you can possibly conceive of. And you've hired big staff, and you're out of a big building and so on. For a guy who prosecuted the worst murderers and rested his case in 2 days and got 100% convictions, it must appear to me as being overplayed, overburdened. But I recall that when computers were first invented, they couldn't put them into a room this size, wasn't big enough. Now you reach into your pocket, you know, and you pull it out, and you push a button, and you can talk to your grandmother in China. I would do it, but I don't have a grandmother in China. I also don't know how to work the damn thing. But what a change, you know, this enormous thing in your pocket. So don't tell me it can't be done. It's done. I've seen it done. I've seen it happening. I'm a victim of it happening. So certainly all of these overloaded, untrained, unskilled people with all the technology, they will be cleared away. These are the cobwebs in the way. And I remember the Wright brothers, you know, where they kept falling on their head all the time. And they would say, if God wanted men to fly, he would have given them wings. God, I don't know who gave them, but there are thousands of planes in the air today. And it was impossible reaching for the moon. We've landed our men on the moon, flying the American flag. You know.
But the Wright brothers didn't have a lot of people who were actually trying to stop them.
I wouldn't say that. They were competing with them.
Okay.
But even trying to stop them. Let's just take that, and that may explain some of the difficulties. That explains why the big powers have not come on board. Because they have managed to hoodwink the public that it's necessary for their self-defense. Let me take a minute on my lead defendant, Otto Ohlendorf. Dr. Otto Ohlendorf. Very nice man. General in the SS. His reports reported that he killed 90,000 Jews. When asked on the stand, is it true that your unit killed 90,000 Jews? He said, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Is this your report? Yes, that's my report. But you know, the men were inclined to exaggerate the body count. Okay, what does it tell you? They're bragging about how many they killed. Now, if you're ashamed and you're acting under pressure, you don't brag about how many you killed. And why did they do that? Well, it was self-defense. Where is your self-defense? Germany attacked France, Belgium, Holland, Norway, Sweden. No, Poland, nobody attacked Germany. Nobody's going to attack Germany. Yeah, but we knew that Russia, Soviet Union planned to attack. And therefore, we had to preempt them by beating them to the punch. And that's why we did it. It was preemptive, putative, Notstand, since you're studying German. Presumed self-defense was the excuse. The three judges, led by Michael Mosmano of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, wrote a detailed rebuttal of that argument, saying what would the world look like if everybody, if he thought that he was going to be attacked, he is justified to go and kill the person first in order to save himself. What would the world look like if that were the rule? The world would look like what it looks like. Why? The United States has the same policy today. They do not preclude anticipatory self-defense as an action to be justified in the interest of the United States, as determined by the United States. That puts me in a very awkward position. I'm an American patriot. I'm very grateful for the opportunity I had in the United States, from where I began with poverty all my life. But when I see that the United States would tolerate the same kind of argument for which I, acting in the name of the United States, obtained a death sentence against a Dr. Otto Ohlendorf, I don't feel good about that. And so that's one of the difficult problems you have. However, let's go back to where we are today. Certainly, the big powers oppose it. They live under the absurd notion. Let me first describe the current policy as I see it. Today, when two major powers are unable to agree, the heads of state, people, crimes are committed by individuals, not by theories or organizations. They're committed by individuals. That was one of the Nuremberg principles. If the two leading individuals are unable to agree, what do? They take a bunch of young people like you, and they send them out to kill another bunch of young people like you, whom they don't even know, for reasons they don't quite understand, in a location which they probably never heard of. This is the policy. What kind of a policy is that? That is homicidal, that is genocidal, that is plain stupid. And that's the policy followed by the United States and by all the major powers. So we begin with that. Do the people want that? I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I don't believe the West Pointers want it. I have the evidence came in my desk yesterday saying they were so excited about your approach to creating a more humane world. And how do you do that? Well, first of all, you have to change the way people think and how people feel. It requires a change of heart and mind. For thousands of years, we have glorified war and the glory of conquest. And war always included rape of women and always will. I was in Berlin shortly after the Russians got in there. They raped everything. It was part of the victory. So we have to change the way they think about war to view it not as a heroic act, but as a despicable crime. As I'm convinced it is as a combat soldier. I have seen the horrors of war close on, and every war contains, it, as the Nuremberg Tribunal held, aggression was the supreme international crime because it incorporated all the other crimes, and it does. Everybody's raping, pillaging, burning. This is what happens in war. The social controls disappear. Now, because they weren't prepared to surrender the what they perceived to be their sovereign right to decide for themselves when they go to war, the states, led by the United States, we are a world leader, said, no, we don't want it. But how you can't say I'm in favor of war, you sound so stupid. So you have to say, well, it hasn't been defined. You have to define it. Well, did Justice Jackson try people for crime without a definition of the crime? It would be absurd to make such a thought. Did then the entire General Assembly, and the other three nations as well that were on the trial, and did the United Nations General Assembly approve that? Did 29 other nations sign on to it? A punishment without defining the crime? That's not true.
So you're saying you think the ICC should have jurisdiction over a properly defined crime of
aggression? Oh, I see. Well, all crimes should be properly defined. A criminal should know when he does the act that this is a punishable
act. No, because some people, as you know, take the position that aggression is simply not a crime that's appropriate for the ICC.
Well, if you think lawmaking is appropriate, and there are people, I give you the correspondence I read, which was quite interesting, between von Moltke, the hero of the Prussian War, Franco-Prussian War, and a guy by the name of Johann Caspar Blünschlier, Swiss name, but he was first professor in Heidelberg. I found the correspondence between them in the old library in Heidelberg, one of my searches. And von Blünschlier writes to the field marshal, and he says, Field Marshal, you were asking me what I'm doing. I'm writing a book. Nations shouldn't go to war anymore. They should come together and settle their disputes in a conference in a peaceful way. The field marshal von Moltke writes back. He says, my dear Blünschlier, are you out of your mind? What are you saying? To give up what is the most glorious in life, to sacrifice for your country, the Kameradschaft, the friendliness with your comrades in war. This is what gives meaning to life. Your idea of a peaceful conference of countries, that's laughable and would destroy everything that we live for. These views still prevail today. They prevail also in West Point last week. And the guy who wrote to me, he said, there are some people, of course, who don't share your vision. And there always will be some people. But the majority of people of the world, they want to live in peace. They don't want to be heroes and have medals from their shoulders down to their knees. So we have to change it. How do you change it? That's where Soros comes in. That's where you come in. I write articles. Nobody reads them. I put it on my website. I don't know who looks at it. But you have to build new institutions. I'm trying to do that now with the earliest kindergarten. People like you, you're a little past kindergarten, but you're still eligible. to begin to see that we must think in terms of tolerance and compassion and a willingness to compromise with views that you think are not acceptable to you. Mm-hmm. Everybody should be able to enjoy the pleasure of being a member of a group. It's a national group or a religious group of their choice. But if they say, if you don't share my view, I'll kill you, that's going a little bit too far. So that's what we've got to do. We're trying to build a new way of thinking about war and peace and the relationship of people in one part of the world to another part of the world with completely different ethics, people of different color, different religion, different nationalism, and all that.
Great. Ben, thank you. Let's should we ask?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Colleagues have questions, comments. You're inspired by this extraordinary gentleman. Anything folks want to say or ask?
Dumbstruck. They don't dare.
You know you'll get an answer that'll be funny and important.
Yeah, that's my defendant. Schmidt, go ahead.
I'm a guilty war criminal. So,
okay.
The challenge I always have with the pacifist view of making all preemptive war illegal or of crime.
Right.
What if the Holocaust had been going on? Should the outside world have just let the Germans carry on? That wasn't the reason for the war.
It's a very good question. It's an excellent question. And I give you an honest answer to it. The honest answer is you can't do anything about it because you haven't built the institutions necessary. You have built a court, but you haven't done anything on the enforcement arm. As long as there is no enforcement arm, you're not going anyplace. You need three components of every lawful society. You need laws to define what's permissible and not permissible. You need courts to determine if they've been violated. And you need a system of effective enforcement. Internationally, we are beginning with the laws. We have them now, some of them. They're defective in many ways, of course, but we are beginning it. We have courts. We are beginning it. They are defective in many ways. Of course they are. They're prototypes. Enforcement, we haven't started yet. The result is you're on a two-legged stool. You can't stand on a two-legged stool. It'll fall on your head. You've got to start building the other things. That takes time. And the enforcement will come not from some academics. It'll come from the people themselves. But they'll say, hell no, I won't go.
Yes, in back. I wonder what your thoughts are.
Alice here is 95 years old. Would you please?
I wonder what your thoughts are on the
come trend. Around here so I can not only see you, I'll see you.
I wonder what your thoughts are on the truth and reconciliation process in South Africa.
What did she say? The truth and reconciliation process in South Africa?
Well, you see, first of all, I don't like to comment on a situation where I don't know all the facts because the newspaper reports are all tilted. Were in favor of the protagonist. So I can't answer your question. But I can say that the worst thing you can do is to rely upon the parties in a dispute to decide whether it's lawful. Because the one who is the aggressor, if you want to call him that, or the perpetrator of crimes against humanity, always thinks he's doing it in the interest of mankind. The victim says, oh no, he's killing me. He's a murderer. You've got to stop him. And the only answer is that if the two parties are unable to agree on peaceful settlement, violent settlement is inevitable. That's the only choice you have left. But we are not doing that. I mean, we are beginning to do it through the courts, court system, finding the middle ground of somebody else deciding. So you ask me a question, and I say if I were the judge hearing the evidence, I would answer your question. But not hearing the evidence, I cannot and wouldn't try to answer your
but
question.
But do you have a view generally about truth processes and how important
Of course
they
you
are?
Should try. Any peaceful means should be tried. Mm-hmm. Anything short of the violence of war, of horrors of war, should be tried. You begin first with discussing it with your adversary. And you don't say, I know I'm right and you know you're wrong. You say, look, can we find a middle ground? You'll have to give some and we'll give some. That's called a compromise. That calls tolerance of another point of view. These are the ideals which have to be inculcated at a very early stage instead of in every classroom in the United States is a flag flying. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and for the Republic for which it stands, etc. One nation, indivisible, liberty and justice for all. But does that mean all Americans or anybody else? Mm. The president ends his speech every time, and every president, he says, God bless the United States of America. What does it sound like to the rest of the world? God bless the United States, to hell with you. You know?
Okay. Yeah. Betsy.
In the Nuremberg trials, some corporate leaders were tried for their role. Okay, good. From the Krupp Corporation, for example. And I'm curious to know what you think about criminal or civil liability for corporations who are involved in mass atrocities.
I think it's horrible, and I'll tell you why.
The idea of criminal or civil liability is horrible.
The idea of criminal liability of corporations. Mm-hmm. You get a crooked bank teller or a crooked corporate chief executive who's earning $100 million a year salary. That's not counting the perks, which are worth another $50 million a year, right? And they screw up and they do something and they do something that's terrible and it's illegal. The first victims are the shareholders. They had nothing to do with it. They cut the dividend, first thing they do. The old widows who invested and trusted the company. Crime is committed not by companies, but by individuals. You look for the person in that company who was responsible. You fire him, you take his money back and put him in jail. That's the way you stop that kind of crime. Not by letting him keep his money and go off somewhere, and then you tell the shareholders, sorry, the company is liable. Liability is a personal matter. Criminality is a personal matter. And we should, regardless of their position, we should hold them accountable personally for their crimes so that, you know, they'd be better off not committing.
Great. Thank you. Allison?
Thank you for your presentation and for your life's work. The first thing I'm going to do after this is going to check out your website to see.
Funny stories there. Read the Benny stories. They're my career in the U.S. Army. Funny things there. That has already been made into a book. In English, and it's not a very good book, and it's been translated literally into French, which is very good, and there are a lot of DVDs coming out and films coming out. Watchers of the Skies, one which is already out, there's one going to be opening up in Nuremberg this week, in the Nuremberg courthouse, and it's called Law, Not War, which sounds vaguely familiar because that's the caption on my letterhead, on my word, perfect, Law, Not War. Those three words, if you can do that, how the world would change. You would have enough money left. You didn't have to spend on armaments to take care of sending you all to graduate school. You'd have enough money left to take care of the old and the sick and the infirm, and they could pay the doctor bills. And all you have to do is recognize that law, the rule of law, is better than war. And I assure you, from my personal experience, even if you get a wrong decision, it's better than war, because there's nothing worse than what I have seen, and the worst is yet to come. We come now from cyberspace. You don't know what hit you. The lights went out, and no lights go on. The electricity is cut off. I got that from a general. I was in St. Petersburg, Russia. And I said, what do you do? He said, well, I'm working on the cyberspace problem. It's from one general to another. I said, well, what's that? He said, well, you know, we can now have the ability to cut off the electrical grid from any city on Earth, on planet Earth. I said, no, I didn't know that. I said, have you figured out how long people would live if you cut off the electrical grid? I mean, I know if you hang a man, it's 6 or 8 minutes before he's pronounced dead. But how long would they live if all the lights went out? The pumps don't work, the phones don't work, the iPhones don't work, the street lights don't work, telephones don't work, hospitals don't work. How long would it take for everybody to be killed? He said, well, I don't know that. I said, well, what's your problem? He said, well, I'm going now from here to China. He said, the problem is that the Chinese can do the same, and so can the Russians. You've got a problem, kids. You better find a better way of settling your differences. Because one day, you won't put on the lights, and they'll never go on. I'll see you down below.
Well, you anticipated my question was just to find out more about your story. So clearly it's on your website. But I also wanted to ask you, you mentioned about the attacks against women in Berlin. And
what do you say?
In Berlin.
In Berlin.
What attacks?
The rape, and I'm curious to know why you think that wasn't reflected in the charges at Nuremberg.
That's why it wasn't reflected in the charges, because you needed Russian consent. We couldn't put rape in. And the International Military Tribunal. We corrected that immediately in the trials under General Telford Taylor. It's been listed as a crime ever since. But because the Russians were notorious rapists, and I was in Berlin very shortly there, I was looking for Hitler. I was at the bunker when there was, before it was flooded. Every German woman, they were hiding under somewhere because it was part of the reward for the war. After, I don't know how many days it went on, but the generals finally interceded and said, okay, boys, now it's enough.
Any other comments or questions, Erica?
I'd be curious in your reflections on the de facto annexation of Crimea.
What? The de facto annexation of Crimea by Russia.
My sister was born in a small village in Transylvania. I was born in the same bed a year and a half later. When she was born, she was a Hungarian. When I was born in the same bed, I was a Romanian. The fact that they changed the designation of the country didn't mean a damn thing to us. She was still my sister, and I was still her brother. They don't pack up a country and move it to the other country. It remains. It's who has the name, because they hope they'll have some better connection with them, either militarily or economically or otherwise. This is nonsense. We are all inhabitants of one small planet, and I wrote a book on that called Planethood, the theme of which is you must learn to share the resources on that planet so that everyone on the planet can live in peace and dignity regardless of their race or creed. That is the theme of that book, and that remains the theme of my life. We have to think in planetary terms. We can no longer think in nationalistic terms where the lines are. What difference does it make? My sister's a Hungarian, I'm a Romanian. They both make the same joke. The Hungarians say, if you want to make a Romanian omelet, first you steal three eggs. Vice versa. Don't take it too seriously.
Well, Ben, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your
I want to thank you and the Soros Foundation for the tremendous work that you're doing, spending all that money to make it a better world in many ways. All of that is very fundamental. But the key point of when they start killing each other, the root cause of what they call war, and I used to call aggression, I don't call it aggression anymore. I call it a crime against humanity, which is what it is. And how do you define a crime against humanity? Very simply. The illegal use of armed force. Illegal means it's not in self-defense and it's not approved by the Security Council of the United Nations. Another way of putting it is the illegal use of force in violation of the UN Charter, knowing that it will inevitably kill large numbers of civilians. That, to me, is a crime against humanity and should be punishable as a crime against humanity under the terms already accepted of the Rome Statute, which lists various crimes against humanity, including a catch-all at the bottom, other inhumane acts. If there is not an other inhumane act included by the deliberate taking armed force and using it, knowing it's going to kill a large number of civilians, then good God bless you, you're all going to be doomed. That is a crime against humanity. And I'd like to hear some more focus on this type of using the law, the criminal law, as a deterrent to that particularly atrocious, the most atrocious of all crimes. I'd be very grateful if Mr. Soros would pass that message on to Mr. Soros. I'd be happy to talk to him about that.
Thank you very much. Okay.